Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
And welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live every Tuesday from the back of Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on the Heritage Radio Network, answering all of your cooking-related questions, technical or not. Call your questions in to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. As usual, joined in the studio here with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez. How are you?
I'm good.
Nice.
That's really nice.
Nice.
That's just because she beat you here.
Yeah.
I was like, Mark, we do have time to shave the back of your neck.
Oh.
That's what's happening now.
Now you all know something about Mark Ladner, my friend.
No. Don't say
all right. Now, also, howdy, Jack, and the rest. You like that? We got a quote like that last week. But I want everyone to know that, was it 2 days ago on Sunday? Nastasha, the Hammer, had dinner with none other than Dr. Ruth, right?
I found out that she is an excellent sniper.
You mean like eBay sniping or killing people?
No, killing people.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So it's like all about the good sex, and if the sex isn't good, take you out from long range without
she
you knowing?
She learned in the orphanage in Switzerland.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Wait. You got to talk more about this. First of all, she's 90 years old, folks, right?
Yeah. And then her parents were, died in a concentration camp. She was taken to an orphanage in Switzerland, and then for some reason, she learned how to be a sniper.
After the war or during the war?
During the war.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, like, that little smile means that she will shoot you straight between the damned eyes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I had no... Is this commonly known Dr. Ruth information?
No, I don't know how it came up.
Well, with Nastasha in the house, you know murder and sniping is going to come up eventually. That's crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Wow. That's impressive. Mm-hmm. That certainly overshadows what I did this weekend. I went to the Sean Casey Animal Shelter in Brooklyn because we were looking to get a pet.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Finally.
Well, Booker wanted a cat, of course, but we can't have cats because, my sister-in-law is deadly allergic to them. And Jen doesn't want a dog.
Right? Oh, so you're getting an iguana.
Nah, but the snakes, I mean, what are you going to do with a snake? I was like, hey, kids, you got to feed this snake whole defrosted mice. You have to purchase packages of like frozen whole mice.
Wow.
They're frozen in kind of a suppository shape so that the snakes can just swallow those suckers without choking. And you thaw them out, you thaw out this dead mouse, you throw it in the cage.
I thought you were supposed to give him a live one.
Well, I mean, I guess you could, but it's probably safer for the snake and kind of less traumatic for the kids if you throw in a frozen.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, whatever. I want a bird now. Now the things I want a bird. You know they have 20-pound turtles there? 20-pound
turtle is
tortoise.
Good.
Yeah,
turtle
they, is they good. Won't they won't give you the tortoise. The tortoise because they don't want to encourage people to own tortoises.
Oh.
This is a rescue only. Anyway, okay. Questions coming in. Hi, thanks for the brilliant show. Well, I don't know about that, but thank you for enjoying it. It's informative and hilarious and the absolute high point of my week. I recently become chef of a medium-sized fine dining restaurant in Bergen, and I can't pronounce it, but soot and salt. But this isn't Bergen County, New Jersey. This is Bergen, Norway.
Cool.
Yeah, very cool. Nothing wrong with Bergen County.
Well.
Stassi's got her Jersey face on now. Actually, I'm going to go to Jersey next weekend, Rock and Mineral Show. The young one wants to go to a Rock and Mineral Show in Jersey.
Cool.
Do you know that New Jersey is one of the mineral capitals of the world?
No.
Yeah, I went there as a kid, too. It's awesome.
Yeah, right? It's cool, right?
Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, see? Minerals. Okay. Where was I? Oh, yes. Somehow I got drawn off track. Can you believe that, Nastasha? so did my iPad. Okay. We normally cook our fish wrapped in cling film. That's plastic wrap for all you guys out there. In the Rationale combi oven with a fairly high delta T. Meaning, if you don't know what we're talking about, it means that he's trying to cook it to a particular temperature. Let's say in the 50 or somewhere Celsius in the middle or below. And then using a much higher temperature, like 60 or something Celsius, to cook it in. Which is actually a standard way of cooking. But in low temperature, we talk about delta Ts. We're talking about very specific differences in temperature between the cooking medium and what we're cooking. Anyway, okay, with a fairly high delta T, usually 65 degrees centigrade for a core temperature of 39 to 42, which is, I don't know what that is, but it's something like 100 and See, 42 is something like 103 or something like that. It's Fahrenheit. It's very low, very low. This is on the very, very low scale of cooking. In fact, most a lot of people wouldn't call it cooking, would call it warming. There's like a lot of debate and contention about whether or not this is I like it, but like this hyper low temperature anyway, let me get finished with the question. This yields a delicious fish in about 5 to 7 minutes, but also a grossly overcooked and ugly exterior. And what I'm assuming is happening is the outside is overcooked because 65 degrees is high. And secondly, when you're cooking low temp in these temperature ranges, right, where you're not getting any seared or any sort of browning on the outside, you get white proteins that come out of basically solution are drawn out and coagulate and look like little specks of almost egg white on the surface of the fish. And they look gross. Anyway, okay, so last night during service, we tried steaming the fish, but not really steaming. Steaming is a misnomer. He had it in the combi oven with 100% humidity at 45 degrees centigrade to a core temperature of 42 centigrade, and it was awesome, stunning. The taste was almost raw, and the texture was almost flaky and completely transparent. It took we cooked it almost 45 minutes. So my problem is this safe? I always say to my customers that all the fish and seafood we serve are unpasteurized and or raw, but is the additional 45 minutes in the danger zone okay? We use very fresh fish, usually in rigor. We dry salt it for 20 minutes beforehand. And thanks, and please say hi to the guys out in Blue Hill Stone Barns. So hello, Blue Hill Stone Barns, from Eric in Bergen, Norway. Okay, so my also, he sent a follow-up email, and he said 45 minutes was not the time needed to get the fish to the core temperature. It was an experiment to see if we could drop the fish in the combi as soon as we got the order in from a customer. Presumably it's a tasting plate, so it comes in early, right? And if it would still be good after that amount of time. I now think it would be better to drop the fish when we have sent all the amuse to the table. That would probably bring the cooking time down to 20 or 30 minutes. We have a vacuum machine, vacuum packer, circulators, and so that's an option instead of heating in the combi oven. Is heat transfer much quicker in a vacuum bag than in a combi? We feel cooking fish in a bag is good, but the look and texture suffers ever so slightly because their machine is small and they use an analog pressure meter, et cetera, so they can never be very accurate with how much vacuum. It was also additional work. Okay, look. Let's knock these out in reverse order. One, I don't feel you have a need to vacuum the fish in a vacuum bag unless you are, I mean, most of us don't have a combi oven, right? And so vacuuming fish in a bag is the only way, or ziplocking a fish in a bag really is the only way we can do low temperature work with fish, right? If you have a combi oven or if you have a, man, the word just went right out of my head. If you have a combi oven or if you have a CVAP, you can do low temperature without it. And in many ways, it's superior because a bag does a couple things. One, it tends to deform the portion slightly, right? Unless you're very good at vacuuming it or you put a lot of oil into it. And two, if you suck a vacuum on fish and cook under a vacuum, I find that the texture is affected. One of the things we do in a low temperature sous vide class that I teach is we serve a variety, the same fish at a variety of different vacuum levels cooked, and everyone can tell the difference in the higher vacked fish. And also, no one really likes usually the super higher vacked fish, and also even some of the medium vacked ones are weird. Ziplocs are usually pretty damn good because they don't have any sort of vacuum effect, but they allow you to cook low temperature and go on cooking issues, which yes, I know I haven't written for in a long time, and you'll see step-by-step instructions on how to put fish in a Ziploc bag. But it is more work. The other advantage of vacuum is you can infuse flavors if you do it, but you're not going to hold these fish for a long time. Secondly, if you're telling people the stuff is raw and unpasteurized, yeah, that's good. That's a good first step. I would not cook these things at that temperature for 45 minutes because you're incubating bacteria at that temperature. I think your 20-minute window is a lot safer, a lot safer. Also, 45 minutes, it might not be a problem with ling. I don't have a lot of experience with ling, but some of your fattier fishes will have enzymes in them that continue to break the fish down over time, and so a 45-minute fish will get mushy. Even if it doesn't get microbially spoiled, it will get mushy. I don't know specifically that when you put a piece of fish into the danger zone, the bacteria doesn't start growing immediately. There's a lag time before the bacteria start growing, and then it goes into a log rate where it's growing at ferocious rates. But the problem is, I don't know exactly how long it's it's going to take to get into the log rate of cooking, but your zone is right in the log area of growth where it's going to grow at a ferocious rate. Then you have the problem that it goes out and you don't know how fast it was being served. I would feel completely comfortable with a fish that you tell people is basically raw, uncooked, unpasteurized, etc., with a 10 to 20 minute cook time and out if they were going to eat it right away and you never had the opportunity of trying to rechill it again and serve it if anything happened. That I'd feel comfortable with. 45 minutes, I'd start to feel a little bit uncomfortable. I mean, you know, again, you're probably not going to do anything, but who knows. Also, certain fish can develop at these low temperatures histamines. I don't know which ones they are, but this is what Bruno Gousseau tells me. I've never done the research because I kind of was looking at him cross-eyed when he was telling me because he just hates this texture of fish. I mean, the real problem is that also is at these super low temperatures, people, if you've never had these things, right? Like this super, super low temperature fish that we're talking about was one of the reasons why a lot of chefs in America, like Wiley Dufresne, my brother-in-law, got into sous vide and low temperature in the first place, was to get these hyper low textures of fish. They look amazing. They look like almost like candy, like jelly, like sometimes like almost like a vacuum infused watermelon, like if it's like something like a salmon. So they look amazing, and the texture is we usually describe it as kind of fudgy and dense. There's a particular temperature window right around there where the intense fishiness of raw fish goes away, and yet it doesn't have the texture of cooked fish, and it's awesome. I really like it. A good 50% of the customers here in New York don't like that texture. And so a lot of people have kind of moved away from that kind of cooking here in the States. But yet, it is a virtuoso thing to do. Did I answer the question? I can't even remember.
Yes.
I did.
And we just got an email from Matthew Leaf that says, "Hey, Nastasia, the way I remember it is that Dr. Ruth became a sniper for Israel after the war."
Oh, after the war.
After the war.
Nice. I'm still trying to imagine this, like, what I've always known as kind of a sweet older woman sniping people.
Yes.
You know? Like a little gun to the head sniping issue thing. Anyway. Mm-hmm. All right. So you want to go to our first commercial break and come back?
Sure.
All right. Let's go to our first commercial break. Call your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Cooking issues. Welcome back to Cooking Issues. Jack, what was that?
That is Fela Kuti, Zombie.
Zombie. Are you gonna put that in with like cranberry zombie, like opposite zombie?
Oh god.
Zombie opposites?
No.
So you know, speaking of zombie, my son is obsessed with this game Zombie Highway. Have you played that game?
That sounds awesome though.
Yeah. Yeah, he was, anyway, I won't get into it. Okay, today's show is sponsored by Modernist Pantry, supplying innovative ingredients for the modern cook. Do you love to experiment with new cooking techniques and ingredients, but hate to overspend for pounds of supplies when only a few grams are needed per application? Do you hate that, Nastasia?
I do.
Yeah. Modernist Pantry has a solution. They offer a wide range of modern ingredients in packages that make sense for the home cook and enthusiast, and most cost only around $5, saving you time, money, and storage space. Whether you're looking for hydrocolloids, pH buffers, or even meat glue, you'll find it at Modernist Pantry. And if you need something that they don't carry, just ask. Chris Anderson and his team will be happy to source it for you. With inexpensive shipping to any country in the world, Modernist Pantry is your one-stop shop for innovative cooking ingredients. Modernist Pantry carries propylene glycol alginate, PGA for short, which is derived from brown algae. Well, it's derived from alginate, from brown algae, and can be used to stabilize emulsions and thicken liquids. It is particularly useful in creating... What the heck are you opening over there? It's like a sound effects thing. She like holds her zipper pocket right next to the microphone and goes, it's crazy. Anyway, where was I? Stabilize emulsions and thicken liquids. It is particularly useful in creating a clean and creamy mouthfeel in beverages. Fans, that's a gross thing to say, right?
Yeah, it's really
gross. Yeah. Nastasha's giving her clean and creamy look. Fans of Cooking Issues that place an order of $25 or more before next week's show will get a free package of PGA to play with. Simply use the promo code CI75 when placing your order online at modernistpantry.com. Visit modernistpantry.com today for all of your modernist cooking needs. All right, so PGA is one of the only ingredients that we use, along with methylcellulose, that is not natural, that we personally, use. And it's derived from alginate, and it's used as a thickener, and especially in beverages. It's been phased out recently because of label declaration problems, because people want to say all natural, and it's not. And the second reason is it's expensive. But it is a fantastic, and unlike alginate, it does not have a problem with acidity. Caller, you are on the air.
Hey, Dave, this is Mark calling from Toronto, Canada.
How you doing?
Great. I'm a big fan of your show. We listen to it all the time, and two good friends of mine are on their honeymoon. They're at your show right now, so big ups to Ann and Adam.
Wait, where are they?
But I do have a question for you.
They're probably those people right there.
What do they look like?
They're, you know, average height. Adam's got a bit of a pot belly.
Wow. I wonder whether they're eating.
But he has a full head of hair, right?
He's got a full head of hair.
Yeah, okay.
They're waving. Yeah. We're waving to him. Oh, that's awesome. You know
awesome.
What? You know what?
I have a question.
Is Indy Jesus here, Jack? Can we get Indy Jesus to serve them?
I haven't seen him.
He might have today off. That's awful.
He's mysteriously missing.
Oh, my gosh. All right. We'll look for him. All right. So your question.
My question is, so I'm interested in trying to do some freeze-drying at home in my freezer.
Ooh.
And I built a couple sous vide machines, so I understand about the temperature controllers. I'm wondering if I can use a pressure controller to sort of put a pressure vessel in my freezer with whatever food I want to freeze-dry, and then sort of decrease the pressure as the temperature goes down, trying to follow the, you know, the triple point line of the water phase.
Okay, so your main problem, I mean, first of all, do you have access to liquid nitrogen and or dry ice?
Dry ice.
Okay. Yeah, you're going to need to, I mean, in general, in a freeze dryer, they'll actually sometimes heat the sample, right? I mean, what you're going to need to do is get, first, do you have a really good vacuum source?
Yeah, I've got a pretty good vacuum pump.
Yeah.
Like a commercial, I can get a commercial vacuum pump.
Like what? But you know, I haven't looked it up recently. But you know, it's basically the vacuum pumps that I use are commercial refrigeration vacuum pumps, and they only get down to about, I'd say, three or four millibar, in that range. And you're going to need to get substantially better. You're going to need to get better than that to get a really good result out of it. You need to get quite low, and you're going to have to ensure that your cold trap, right, that can you know, it's basically what, you know, for those of you who don't know freeze drying, what you do is you freeze something typically, then you place it in a vessel, you suck a vacuum on it, and in between that and the vacuum, you put a cold trap, and the liquids that are frozen solids, such as solids frozen in the thing, sublimate, turn to a gas, migrate to the cold trap where they're frozen in the cold trap, and you maintain a vacuum until the majority of the liquid that's in the product, or what would be a liquid in the product, has sublimated and migrated over to the cold trap. That's the theory of operation of it. But typically you need to get a fairly cold cold trap, so dry ice is fine. Anything, I think, below about minus 60 Celsius, I think, is okay. But colder is typically better. But you're going to need to keep it cold the whole time. If you can, I would use your vacuum pump to also vacuum insulate the cold trap on the outside. It's going to stop your heat loss and prolong the life of your coolant, of your dry ice. The other thing is, the temperature control and a freezer would work. But your main problem is going to be getting the vacuum right and making sure your cold trap stays cold. I've never had luck, let's put it that way. And I tried it in the Rotovap, basically using the Rotovap as a kind of a cheap way to freeze dry with my refrigeration vacuum pump. But again, that only got down, even I tweaked it all the way out, and it got down to maybe like 2-3 millibar, and still I did not get any luck. But I encourage you to try and tell me what happens.
Okay, will do. I'll keep experimenting and post something on the blog if anything works.
Please do. Please do. Thanks for calling it.
My pleasure.
All right. Okay. Wait, we have a follow-up. So We have a question in.
Other order. There you
other
go.
Other order. Here we go. Yep. From Aaron Call. Hey, Cooking Issues team. Great show. I started listening a couple months ago. I'm getting caught up with all the back shows. I recently decided to do a DIY, that's do-it-yourself, circulator and just got it finished last weekend. I started with the Seattle Food Geek and Oh My Puddin' plans, which I don't know those particular ones, but I'm sure they're well-known plans on the internets. But they made a few changes, what I think are improvements. So that leads to my question. First, the fish tank pump I started with died around 55 degrees Celsius. I am now using a $15 high-temperature pump that only moves 1 liter per minute, roughly 16 gallons per hour. Using several probes, it seems to be acceptable in a small bath with one bag. Do you think this is enough movement, or can you recommend a faster high-temperature pump that won't break the bank? Okay, that I do not think that's enough. Look, any minor circulation is going to be enough for one bag and a pot because you just need to get the thing moving. The problem is if you put the heater into a bigger unit and then you have a lot of bags in it, you're going to have issues with dead spots. So a higher flow pump is going to be better typically. The last time I did one, I used a pump that was recommended on the brewer's forums. I forget what it is, but it wasn't that expensive for recirculated mash pumps, RIMS method, and those pumps handle water quite well and I believe can go up into the mid-60s or better Celsius. So you might want to check out the brewer's forums for recirculated mash pump setups, and they all have cheap ones. I just can't remember off the top of my head. It's also readily available, the pump, I remember, from sources like Grainger or eBay. Okay, second. Second, about safety. I know this is a topic you've addressed before, but I wonder if you could quickly run through some safety tips. I'm using Ziploc bags. Under what circumstances and how critical is getting every last bit of air out? This is tough with ground meat. Is there an absolute minimum temperature to which you'd cook grocery store beef, chicken, whole or ground? Can I add anything to the bag to adjust pH or oxygen to help? Anything else? Thanks, Aaron Call. Okay, look, and I'll hit the follow-up when I wrote in. okay. I'll do the follow-up afterwards. So the deal is with safety, you don't need to get all of the air out of the bag. The reason to get all – you're not trying to do preservation for a long time. You're trying to cook, right? So getting the air out isn't as big a deal. That said, you can get some oxidation if there's an excess amount of air, especially on something like a crème anglaise. When you're cooking a crème anglaise, you want to get the air out because I've noticed you get more of kind of an eggy, sulfury taste if you don't. That's why – even though I cook a lot of meats in Ziploc bags at home, I really do prefer vacuuming for something like a crème anglaise when you're cooking it. Ground meat, you don't want to get all the air out. If you did, it would be, you know, like a puck. It would be like a sausage. You wouldn't want that. So you want to keep it not dense and crushed down. So the minimum temperature I would cook, depends what you mean by minimum. The minimum temperature that I typically recommend for people to cook at is about 54.4 Celsius, because that's the minimum temperature for beef on the food, you know, the FSIS USDA website. So that's the lowest temperature that I usually recommend. There are people that recommend lower. I typically will cook at 55, like steak, I will typically, and even ground meat, if you cook it long enough, you have to cook it long enough because you put a lot of bacteria into the inside of the meat when you grind it, but 55 for steak, and usually for a hamburger, I'll do like 56 if I want like a rarish, medium rarish kind of thing. Cook it through. Then if you want it to maintain rare all the way through, drop the temperature to 50 degrees Celsius for about 30 minutes to cool it down. Then sear the hell out of it to get a crust on it. If you want the burger to have more of a standard taste, then don't chill it before you cook it, and you'll be fine. But that's typically what I do. And as the follow-up, I took copious notes and decent photos through the process of making the circulator. You mentioned you have a close relationship to the PolyScience guys, so I don't know whether you'd be interested, but I'm happy to write it up and send it to you to use as a blog post, another resource, or even just for your amusement or a critique. It's surely no thing of beauty, but I think an improvement over the other plans that already exist on the internet with greater detail in the construction steps. Let me know if it's worth my time to draft, and I'll send it your way. Why don't you send some of the photos to Stas? She'll look at it. Yeah. She's a rough critic. You're the roughest critic in the world. She hates 90% of the stuff I do. And she hangs out on the weekend with snipers. Right? Okay. Paul writes in with a comment on last week's show where I forget who it was called in and said he had problems with his chickens being tough. Every like fifth chicken breast was being tough from the Costco. And he says virtually all broilers, all 9 billion of them that are slaughtered in the U.S. 9 billion. Jesus.
Wow.
In the U.S. are slaughtered at essentially the same age, 40 to 45 days. So tough chicken is likely not an age effect. I agree. But the question is, what is the effect then? Has anyone else noticed the 1 in 5 tough breast problem at Costco? Have you noticed that?
No.
And then
there is a Costco in the Bronx.
Really?
In Harlem.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
How do you know this?
I passed it.
How did
on
you
the
pass?
Train. If
oh.
you go on the Metro North, you can see Target and Costco.
The funny thing is, it's actually easier for me to fly to Europe than it is for me to go to,
yeah,
above. Yeah, it's crazy. For those of you that don't know New York, like, we think we're hot snots here, but I mean, I don't mean that in a bad way. You know what I'm talking about. And but the thing is that we're so provincial, we hardly ever leave within like 10 blocks or 20 blocks of where we live. We're like, oh my God, uptown. I have to go uptown. You know, coming out to Brooklyn here, basically, I feel like I'm an adventurer, an explorer, because I live in Manhattan. And people in Brooklyn, I guess, sometimes feel the same way. They're like, oh, man, I got to go into the city. I got to go to Manhattan. Jesus.
Yeah.
Anyway, weird.
Yep.
What do you think, Jack?
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel when I have to go to the city.
Yeah, see? But notice they call it the city. Yeah, booyah! Okay. And a question from Paul. Over the last month, Dave has mentioned two preferred knife sharpening tools, Duo Sharp and Edge Pro. Can you comment on the need to have both, or is one preferred, and which one? So the Edge Pro is a sharpening system. And it's one of the sharpening systems. It's based on fixing the angle between the knife blade and the sharpening tool. So basically, you have on the Edge Pro, you hold the knife by the handle with the blade facing towards you, and there's a stick on it that you rub back and forth over the surface of the knife, and that stick's maintained at a very precise angle. So you can get both sides of the knife, and you don't have to think, you don't have to look, and you can sharpen a billion knives in like 13 seconds once you set it up. It takes like 5-6 minutes to set it up. Once you set it up, you can sharpen all your knives very quickly to the same edge angle. It's extremely repeatable. So if you want to, if you know you want a particular edge angle on something, you can just rip them all through. Right now, it's not very effective if you only need to do one or two knives, or if you need to constantly change your angles, or if all of your knives are at different edge angles, because then you're having to reset it each time and all this other stuff. I do like it for multiple things, and it gets things unbelievably sharp. Okay, and it has a wide range of grits on it, and you can replace the grits, and this, the things stay true and they don't gouge out. The Duo Sharp is basically just a large hand diamond whetstone, right? And what I, it requires you to have a traditionally sharpening your knives, it requires you to use your senses, your hands, your eyes, and your finger when you're feeling for the burr edge to determine whether you've gotten the angle correct on the sharpening and, when you're done, et cetera, et cetera. They have a grit on both sides. What I like about the Duo Sharp is it's extremely thin, it's fairly light, and it will never warp, and you'll never gouge it out because it's diamond. So like a lot of the Japanese water stones have problems where they get gouged and they have to be retrued over time. That said, like I say, most like high-end chefs, they still adhere to their their Japanese water stones, and they would probably scoff at my Duo Sharp that I have around. But when I use it, my knives are freaking sharp, and I get the people who are like, all right, that's freaking sharp. And Nils, who is a Waterstone man for many years, tried mine when I was away once and was like, all right, I'm getting one of these suckers because you know what? It's easy to fit in my bag. I don't have to freaking soak it in water. It doesn't make a mess all over my knives the way that the Waterstones do. And I don't have to retrue it ever. Done, 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 and done. Right? Hey, look, if you don't like it, call up and blame me and tell me I'm a jerkwad. But make sure you get the really, really the green and red one. Don't get one of the coarser ones. It's not going to be happy for you. Okay. So I have a. Should we do one more quick commercial break there, Jack? What do you think?
Yes.
Commercial break. Cooking issues. Don't bring dashi and bushi to Africa?
That's exactly what he was saying.
This is a Japanese food hater from Africa?
Yeah, man.
What was that?
Fighting words. Well, I had to just, it was a quick commercial break called by you, so I had to just click on something.
But what the heck was that?
That was Sean Cootie. I'm guessing Fela Cootie's son.
And the whole premise of this is I do not want to see a Japanese store in Africa. And furthermore, I do not want to see any sort of crappy Japanese-African fusion cuisine with your dashi-based stuff in my food, basically.
Yeah.
That's crazy, crazy stuff. Crazy stuff. Stas, you would like that. Mm-hmm. Stas does not like kombu. You like dashi, though.
Yeah.
As long as it's got the katsu bushi in it.
Yeah.
But don't bring bushi to that guy. Don't do it.
Don't do it.
Don't do it. He's not pleased with it. Okay, wow. I can't even think about anything else. My whole life's outlook is like changed. I did not realize there was such a katsuobushi hating crowd out there weird. Okay. Hey, Nastasha. Just you. I love what you and Dave... Oh, I love what you and Dave do. But mostly you, Nastasha.
Well, they know I read.
They know you read?
Yeah, the emails.
Oh, I see. I mean, she can also read. She has that capability. Anyway, I have two questions. Okay, listen, I'm going to answer the first question, or really I'm going to postpone because I really don't know the answer to the first question. And the second one, I'm going to do your question along with someone else's question because it's one of those rare instances where I've gotten very similar questions in the same week. Okay. One, where does the term 86 come from? So those of you who don't know what we're talking about, usually there's a number of things. You can say someone is 86, which means they're no longer welcome, right, in a restaurant or a place. Or you could say an item is 86, and that means we're out of it and stop serving it, right? So, you know, when last night, when we ran out of the peach, by the way, listen to this. At the bar, Booker and Dax, we have a peach dish on the menu, a peach drink. I don't want to hear about it, about how it's not peach season. Let me tell you something. It's never freaking peach season in New York, right? I mean, like, we grow peaches here.
Remember when we had those really good ones?
Were they from New York? No, they were from this. Remember, we bought them in Harlem, but they were trucked up from, like, down south somewhere, mm-hmm. like Maryland or some crap. Mm-hmm. And he's known for that, right? New York is not, like, look, I have the book Peaches in New York, so I'm fully aware of the history of peach growing in New York State, okay? But it's, you know, look, it's not our finest point. But the fact of the matter is, right, that peaches, when they are in season, don't last very long. And so you have a boatload of peaches lying around. So the question is, you can either make a traditional peach brandy with it, which is delicious, right? Or you can make peach jam, or you can make canned peaches, which Nastasha happens to find incredibly delicious. Do you not?
I love them so much.
You like a canned peach, right?
They are my favorite thing.
Yeah. In fact, Nastasha likes a canned peach not as a substitute for a fresh peach, but rather as its own thing.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So Nastasha said, hey, look, you know, it's winter time out. Why don't we make canned peaches a drink and put it on the menu? So we made canned peach juice, right? And then Karen Jarman, one of our bartenders, made a delicious tequila mezcal umeboshi vinegar canned peach drink. Which, you know, it's clarified in the centerfuge list. But people are like, oh my God, it's not seasonal. But it totally is seasonal. It's absolutely seasonal.
Canned peaches are always in season.
Well, no. Canned peaches are not in season in the height of summer. You should be saving them for other times.
Okay. Well, they're always in season for me.
Yes. Anyway, my point is, it's okay to use it as long as you use it for the right reasons. That made that up. It's weird. Oh, that reminds me. But I know I'm not going to have time, but I have to go through it anyway. As I was walking here to the radio show, I looked on the street, and there was an empty kind of crushed box of Hot Pockets on the street. Hot Pockets. You familiar with Hot Pockets?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, my kids, I don't know what the hell it is. My kids, like, go to the store, they look in the thing, and they want the freaking Hot Pockets. And the thing is that the only television they ever watch is streamed through Netflix or Hulu. So they've never seen the commercial where they're like, Hot Pockets. Now, I know that, like, Hot Pockets is like a, you know, that tune, like, I almost want to buy it, you know, and the word Hot Pocket, like, has that awesome, like, alliteration, Hot Pocket, you know what I mean? It's like, and if they hired, like, Snoop Dogg to just get on the air and go, like, Hot Pockets, Hot Pockets, Hot Pockets, I would buy it. Like, if he just said it, like, 5 times in a row, I would do nothing but buy Hot Pockets. You know what I mean? But how the hell do my kids know this? What kind of evil marketing genius do they have that can make a kid look at a box of freaking Hot Pockets and say, Daddy, buy me those damn things?
I don't.
What was the sound effect? I like that. What was that?
Actually, yeah, for those who don't know the Hot Pockets song.
Oh, do it.
Do it. When you want a hot meal without a big
deal, what are you gonna pick? Hot Pockets! Yeah!
When a hungry bunch shows up for lunch, what are you gonna pick? Hot Pockets!
Hot Pockets, filled with delicious pepperoni pizza, chicken and cheddar, ham and cheese, in a crispy pocket.
It's not crispy usually.
What are you gonna pick? Hot
Yeah. A hot meal.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go out and buy me some Hot Pockets.
Oh, but, don't do that.
No, I'm not. But the thing is, how would my kids know that? They've never seen that. I mean, that commercial is a sale, Jack. Come on now.
It's pretty good.
It's pretty damn good. Anyway, Hot Pockets. Okay.
Maybe we need to make a modernist pantry commercial like that.
Yeah.
Oh, man. All right. So the second... So 86. I don't know how the hell we got into this. Okay, so 86. Anyway, the point is that when you 86 something, it's gone, or you have to get rid of the person, et cetera, et cetera. Now, it's like many terms of this nature, there's no accepted derivation of it. The etymologies are kind of all BS, and they're all based on like a very tenuous reasoning. Some people say that, you know, Delmonico's, the restaurant, had an item, number 86, that was always out. Some people have said that it comes from a streetcar where the 86th Street was the last stop. Some people have said it comes from, you know, the crew on a ship that only had 85, and so the 86th person wasn't there, et cetera, et cetera. Supposedly there was a law about alcohol service that was, you know, Article 86, that no one's ever seen the article or printed it, et cetera. There's a table that only had 85 seats and 86, et cetera, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, these all seem to be pretty much to be horse hockey. The other good one is Chumley's, which is a famous speakeasy in New York, or was a speakeasy, is number 86 on its street, and so they would throw people out and they'd see the 86 sign. Go to Snopes.com for, you know, basically a good rundown of all this, but all this stuff seems kind of nonsense. The Snopes writer, I believe it's a woman, I forget who it is, I couldn't copy it because they have an anti-like copyright. They won't let me right-click and paste, but her main thesis is probably it's a rhyming slang, 86 for Knicks. You know what I mean? Nix it, nix something, nix it, 86. Oh. Anyway, but there's also a whole host of – I didn't have a chance to find my copy, but Darcy O'Neill's Fix the Pumps has a lot of old soda slang jargon in it, and that, you know, and also probably old diner slang, and that's one of those old terms, so he might go into the etymology, and he's good with that kind of a thing. The book Fix the Pumps, by the way, is an old slang term for check out the woman with the large breasts. Basically, fix the pumps. That's what the slang is for. Anyway, so what do you think? Does that answer that question? Mm-hmm. Basically, I don't think there is an answer. The second question is quite interesting, is two, when it comes to soaking livers, may it be monkfish, duck, chicken, or even beef, what difference does it make to soak it in water, carbonated water, or milk? What works best? The carbonated water, actually, and this is from Philippe, the carbonated water I'd never heard of, but it's interesting. I did notice in the 1890s there was reference if a bird was gamey or if parts of things were gamey to wipe it with soda water. But my presumption when they say soda water isn't carbonated water, but water with baking soda in it, or you know, and so, you know, or cooking soda in it, and that seems to me to make more sense, because then they say to pack it with charcoal to get rid of the bad odors, right? Because you're going to cook that damn thing, you're not going to throw it away, back in the 1890s Boston Cooking School book. So I'm wondering whether that carbonated water is actually a modern thing that has some sort of scientific merit, or whether it's a misread of soda water from a much older technique of deodorizing a gamey bird. The other thing, whether it's going to be water or milk and what works best, I'm going to combine in with a question we have on sweetbreads from Adam Lazarek. I was hoping you could give your opinion on soaking sweetbreads, livers, and other offal, mainly touching on using milk or not. If milk, why exactly is it used, and are there other alternatives? Is there a time maybe you could touch on your preferred cooking technique for cooking sweetbreads, i.e. in court bouillon, sous vide or not, to press or not, peel before or after, and so on? I've always soaked in milk, poached and then pressed, but never really questioned why to press and soak in milk. Okay, so I'm going to handle those two things at once. Here's the deal. Most of the cooking techniques for offal involve getting... It's a horrible word, right?
Yes.
But even like all of the alternatives they use for offal are also awful. Like variety meats. Variety. Sounds terrible, right? Anyway, a lot of these techniques are made to either get rid of residual blood in them, because there's they're not muscle, and so a lot of times you want to get rid of the blood, like in sweetbreads, so that the color is good. So soaking helps with that, or to get rid of the off flavors that develop, because these things spoil relatively quickly compared to muscle meats and tend to have a higher bacterial contamination at the beginning, right? And they also tend to have a lot of fat that tends to break down more than the fat in regular whole muscle cuts. And so you have fat oxidation, you have microbial spoilage, and you have a lot of other things that cause these things to kind of be stinky and to need a little special tender loving care before they're cooked. And that's a lot of times what the soak is doing. Also, if you're going to poach something, they'll typically say put it in cold and bring it up when you're poaching it. And that's also to draw stuff out. And McGee mentions this, that you start cold and bring it up so that you can so that basically you're drawing soluble proteins out, and then once they're drawn out cold, then they coagulate on the surface, and you can skim off that undesirable scum that floats on the top of the blanching pot when you're doing poaching of offal and sweetbreads and things like this. Now, milk is very interesting because a lot of these cuts can develop off flavors due to fat breakdown, rancidity, and basically just the breakdown, free fatty acids, things like this. And they have a lot of lipid-based off flavors in them. If you soak in milk, milk is going to be better. This is, by the way, just off the top of my head, but I believe it to be true. But this is not based in like scientific research. This is what I'm telling you. And someone can come back and tell me I'm a jerk or an idiot, which I'm sure they will. Like milk is good because it's water, but it has a fat in it. So I'm thinking skim milk probably wouldn't be as good for this, right? And it would suck out some of the fat based off flavors, right? Better than water alone would. That's my guess. What do you think about that guess, Nastasha?
That's a good guess.
Yeah, good guess. Anyway, so the soaking is to draw out things that are soluble, that are not bound, that can be taken off. Salt is going to flavor it. It's also going to probably help it out texturally. If you use salt water, salted milk might be a good alternative. And I think that's what's going on. And then you never keep the milk. You discard it because it apparently is sucking up all the evil humor. Right? And so that is my guess for that. Are there any other like partially fatty things that you could use like that? I mean, I bet you could make a soaking thing that wasn't milk if you were allergic to milk. You could like emulsify some fat into something with an emulsifier and then add it to it. You think that might work? Like take a Lloyd 310S, use that to make like an olive oil water emulsion, or use an ultrasonic homogenizer to make a milk out of you could do it. I mean, you could make a non-milk-based alternative if the question is that you can't use milk. I tend to do, and I don't know why, but I tend to do the old school with sweetbreads. I will soak them in salt water, poach them in milk, press them, and then fry them. But I don't know why. I like a crispy sweetbread, by the way. I don't do sous vide or any of that stuff on it. I should. I have the instructions for it or the temperatures for it on the blog in the cooking chart. But typically, I do it the old school way because I like a crunchy sweetbread, right, and not a mushy one. Do you like a mushy sweetbread or crunchy?
No, crunchy.
Crunchy, yeah. I press it so it stays together. I put salt water in the soak so that it tastes good and draws out the extra blood and whatnot, and I use milk because I don't know why. I just do it. You know what I mean? Right?
Yes.
I mean, there's no better. Oh, by the way, if you like sweetbreads, but you don't like bovine spongiform encephalopathy, aka mad cow, or if you're worried about it, I don't know if people are still worried about that nowadays, or if you're worried about any sort of TSE, transmissible spongiform encephalopathy, which is degenerative brain disorder related to Jakob's Creutzfeldt, very similar, 100% fatal, takes a long time. Anyway, if you're worried about that, you can make something, a very passable fake sweetbread using chicken skins. You just roll up, you sprinkle chicken skins with salt and meat glue, roll them into a roulade, let them set, poach them off, cut them into pinwheels, and deep fry them, and they are very similar to sweetbreads. And delicious, I might add. Very delicious.
Hey, Dave, I hate to do this, but it's time.
Oh, man, I can't get the one last one?
We got to get the next caller on the line for the next show.
Oh, man. All right, listen, Lee Kalman, I have your question on hearts. On how to cook hearts, and I will tell you my answers on it next week. And it involves an article called "Studies on the Development of Tenderized Chicken Gizzard and Goat Heart Pickles."
Vicious, vicious.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
And a I just can't get it straight. Vicious, vicious.